Flee sexual immorality. Every sin that a man does is outside the body, but he who commits sexual immorality sins against his own body. Or do you not know that your body is the temple of the Holy Spirit, who is in you, whom you have from God, and that you are not your own? For you were bought at a price. Therefore glorify God in your body. I'll end the sentence there. The "in your spirits, which are God's," I suggest, is a gloss. This emphasis here is on the body. Now, just to take a catalog of the things that we've read that the body is for the Lord and the Lord is for the body. That's one consideration. We've read that our bodies are members of Christ. That's a second point. We've read that our bodies are the temple of the Holy Spirit. A third important point. And finally, that we have been bought at a price. I want to talk to you about your body for a little while this afternoon. And I want to use this text, and it's not all going to be about sexual immorality, so some of you who are tense about that can relax slightly, although I am going to say some things about that. But this is much wider applicability, and I think it fits very well with the foundations that we've been hearing about from Psalm chapter 11. Let me begin by explaining what I think Paul is doing in verse 12 and on. All things are lawful for me, quote unquote. But then Paul adds this, not all things are helpful. Quote unquote, all things are lawful unto me. Now, who is he quoting or whom is he quoting? One possibility is that they're quoting Paul, and they're parroting that to him, and he's sending it right back, but with correction, because they're quoting him out of context. I think perhaps more likely, though, they are actually quoting a Corinthian slogan. Because I want you to actually analyze this little pericope, this little piece that we're talking about here in verse 12 through 14 by beginning at the end and moving backwards. Here's what we need to know. The body is for the Lord, and the Lord is for the body. And the Lord himself, who had a body, ultimately he was for the body by taking a body, well, that Lord was raised from the dead. And his resurrection is a guarantee that your body is going to be raised from the dead. Therefore, we can conclude that the Lord is for the body is for the Lord, and the body will be raised up and glorified. Now we back up. It says, meats for the belly for meats. The body is a food receptacle, and foods grow on the earth so that they might stuff the body. That doesn't sound like what we just said. The Lord is for the body and the body is for the Lord. And then it says God will destroy both it and them. So there's no future for them. Who cares what happens to them now? They'll be gone. But I thought we just read that they'll be raised and that the body isn't going to be terminated, but in fact it is going to be glorified. Therefore, all of this stuff at the beginning is wrong. So what Paul's saying is you Corinthians seem to be very fond of slogans. You like to say, all things are lawful for me. You like to say, meats for the belly and the belly for meats. Well, I want you to jettison those slogans, and I'm going to give you a better slogan. The body is for the Lord, and the Lord is for the body. You can chant that if you want to chant something. The body is for the Lord, and the Lord is for the body. That's the right cliche. And that's the one you need to remember. So he is dispelling the idea that they can do whatever they want with their bodies, because that's what Corinth told them, and that's what Canada tells you today, and that wonderfully immoral country I come from as well. Now, I want you to realize that Paul is not reestablishing legalism. There is a sense in which he is saying, yes, it is true, all things are lawful for me. But to those who are free, and we're going to talk about what freedom means in a moment, there are two major considerations when I am about to exercise my Christian liberty. Number one is the test or the law of love. Let's look at it, first verse. All things are lawful for me, but all things are not helpful. If something that I wish to do isn't helpful, certainly for myself, but more importantly for you, then it is not being motivated by love, and it has failed the love test. And therefore, it's illegitimate. There's a second test. All things are lawful for me. I can do whatever I want. Yes, but consider this. I will not be brought under the bondage of any. That's the liberty test. And so the behavior I'm talking about needs to be put through that grid also. And if I understand that at the end of the day, it will be the master and I will be the slave, then it isn't freedom, it isn't legitimate, and it's not lawful. So Paul says, if this is me you're quoting, if it is I you're quoting, then I want you to put it this way, all lawful things are lawful unto me. Not that we are under an external code any longer that constrains us from without, but rather remember law and liberty, the two things that we're using to judge behaviors, do not come from without. They come from within. They are the products of the Spirit of God. You do not need legalism to be able to perform God's will. You need God's Spirit within you, generating love and bringing liberty. For where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is liberty. Now, the background we have here is a society that is functionally atheist and physically hedonist. So we're going to talk about this for a moment. So you see people who are about to commit a crime. They're about to steal some candy off the shelf. We'll make this relevant to even the small boys, right? And they look to the left. And they look to the right. And over the shoulder. And they filch it. Which is the direction they didn't look? They forgot to look up. Do you know the Lord tells us that there was a man who owed his master 10,000 talents. That's about maybe $2 billion. That's a lot of money. And he had a fellow servant, and he owed that fellow servant 100 pennies or 100 denarii, which was maybe, let's be generous and say the man had a good job and a day's wage, and you do the math and you figure out this is maybe $20,000. Well, that's a lot of money. But $20,000 that I owe horizontally is nothing compared to $2 billion that I owe vertically. And people fail in their calculus when they think about behavior and sin to remember that their true debt is upward. People say, no one gets hurt. Well, first of all, if sex is involved, somebody gets hurt. Period. The end. You don't know what you're talking about if you've not lived long enough to realize that. Take my word for it. Any sex outside of marriage is going to hurt. That's $20,000 to the right and to the left. But the true debt is upward. $2 billion owed to God. You say, well, I do things on my own and no one else is involved, so how can anyone else be hurt? I have no horizontal debt. Yes, but you owe God $2 billion. Because He is the one to whom you are accountable. And anytime you live your life looking to the right and looking to the left and looking over your shoulder and failing to look upward, you are a functional atheist. And there are Christians, unfortunately, who fall into that habit. Let us not do that. The other thing that we find in the Corinthian society that we'll find in our own is what I'm going to call physical hedonism. That is, as is expressed in these expressions here, life is about acquiring fun things to do, fun things to own, and basically the pleasures of the body. Now, of course, in Corinth, they're heavily influenced, without getting into this in too much detail, by Platonic philosophy, which basically said the body is evil. The body is absolutely a prison for the spirit. That's what Plato taught. And so there's two things you can do with this useless prison of a body, this husk that I have to live in. Number one, you can be really hard on it and punish it because it's so worthless. But, you know, that's not the most pleasant way to live. Or you can just let it do whatever it wants. It's food's for it. It's for food. It's a food receptacle. It's not worth anything else. It's for sex. Sex is for it. That's just the way it is. Let it happen because it's all going to be destroyed at the end and your spirit will then go up in purity to God. And He won't care what happened to that body because He doesn't have any future for that body. And Paul says just the opposite. The body is for the Lord and the Lord is for the body and the Lord had a body and the Lord has a body. And His body has been raised, and so is yours. So what you do with your body today is utterly important to God. Absolutely important. And yet, the society tells us that we are here to have fun. We're here to work during the week just to make enough money so we can fly on the weekends. Well, I'm going to let you in on a little secret. I have a couple of secrets for you, for the young, for the teenagers that I was so hard on yesterday. Here is one secret. You were made to work. We didn't get into that in the garden, but that was the next step. Do you know you will never be happy in life unless you're working? You say, well, you flew a lot of miles from Detroit to come and tell me something that sounds like pure nonsense. I like play. I don't like work. No, after you've lived a little while and after you've tried work and after you've seen a project conceived and carried out and perfected and something that has lasting value accomplished, and this could be certainly true in the spiritual realm as well, another book memorized, another scripture truth that's under my belt, and I understand that this was a process that took some toil and sweat and tears along the way, and the product that I have is priceless, and I am a person who has joy because I have been industrious, and I have had the work ethic to carry something through. I've worked as God intended me to work, and I'm a happy creature. And any person who does not understand that and believes that work is drudgery and that play is what we're here for has much to learn, and they will learn it the hard way, that that is a life of pain and disappointment. So with that backdrop, let's think about these laws as I'm calling them to the person who is not under law, their principles about the inward man. First of all, the law of love. A lot of people say, well, the Old Testament's full of rules and regulations, but the New Testament doesn't have any. I don't know what New Testament they're reading. That's not the way I read it. There's a difference between not being under law, not being in covenant relationship with God, to God with a law that by breaking I will void that covenant and incur his wrath as the people of Israel did. There's a difference between God telling us what is right, which we ought to love. We ought to be very fond and drawn toward what he loves. After all, he's our God and we love him and we love what he loves. But we understand that when he gives us that list on the outside and we try to perform it with our own strength, we'll be frustrated. And he never intended us to do that. What he intended was to come into our hearts and give us his spirit. So let me tell you what liberty really is. Liberty is the desire and the ability to do the will of God. Period. Paul says in Romans chapter 6, but God be thanked that although you were the servants, the slaves of sin, yet you were, the way that it's put in the King James Version, I just want to use this expression, God poured you into a mold. So God be thanked that though you were servants of sin, you became the servants of righteousness. You became conformed to the mold into which you were poured. I'm not quoting that correctly. I'm going between two versions. So let's look that up. Romans 6 and 17, because it's making a point that I want to make without failing. Yeah, the form of doctrine is what I was trying to come up with. So here it is, Romans 6 and 17. But God be thanked that though you were slaves of sin, yet you obeyed from the heart that form of doctrine to which you were delivered, and having been set free from sin, you became slaves of righteousness. Now, here are a couple of important points to gather from that verse. Number one, everyone's a slave. Everyone's a servant. So whatever you think of as liberty must be seen in terms of service. It is either service to God or service to the flesh. It's either service to God or to mammon. It's either service to God or to the devil. And when Christ liberates a person, he takes him out from under the bondage of sin and Satan and the world and the flesh, and he gives him a new service to a master, Christ. You see, we're all contingent beings. If you think that freedom is being able to do whatever you want, you're wrong. Only God has the ability to do whatever he wants, and even God cannot do everything. God can only do what he wants to do. You say, are you sure about that? I'm absolutely sure. God cannot square a circle. God cannot lie. He cannot do those things. You say, then he's not free. Yes, he is free. He is free to do what is right. He is free to follow his own nature. He is free to be what he is. And humans will only be free if they do what they were designed to be. You take a locomotive. I saw one this morning. It slowed me about 10 minutes from getting to the morning meeting over there. But I was early, so it was fine. And I thought, wow, that's an amazing machine pulling all of these cars. What if you took that locomotive and put it out in the field with the tractors? It would be an embarrassment. It would be bogged down instantly. It would not go anywhere. It would be a laughingstock. Why? Because it's designed to run on rails. And when it's running on rails, it is free. But when it is doing what it is not designed to do, it's in bondage. And we could go on and on with examples of this. You were designed to do God's will and to glorify Him. If you do anything else, you are not free. You're in bondage. So we must think about our bodies in terms of whether or not they're doing what God designed them to do and whether they're doing the will of God. But notice another point from Romans 6. It's not obeying. You said, I thought it said obeying. No, it doesn't say obeying. It says obeying from the heart. Those who serve God and who are indwelt by His Spirit and are free men and free women do what they want to do. And what do they want to do? They want to obey God. Psalm 37 says, delight thyself also in the Lord, and He shall give thee the desires of thy heart. Freedom begins with wanting to do the right thing. Anyone who does not want to do the right thing cannot be free, even if external constraints are removed and he's allowed to do something, he won't do what he ought to do, and therefore he cannot be free, unless first the desire. And if we were to read, and I don't have the time to do it, in Galatians chapter 5, it says, freedom is this, serving one another out of love. You say, here he goes again. He says liberty, he says free, and then immediately he brings up the word serve, slave. That's because we were designed to serve. And if freedom is doing what you were designed to do, then you will not be free unless you're serving. But that service comes from within, not from without. It comes from love. It does not come from an outside source called the law that tries to get me to do what I do not want to do. A free person, I will repeat my definition, has both the desire and the ability to do the will of God. That's what we need to be doing with our bodies. Let me illustrate this to you. This is sort of a truth from Galatians that we could talk about by reading some verses, but I'm just going to use an illustration. Let's say, I'll use myself, all right? Now, we live, I was brought up on a sort of hobby farm. There was a lot of mud, all right? And my mom had carpets. And so there had to be a law in our house. You must remove your boots before you can come into the living room. Now, in my heart, I didn't care about carpets. I didn't care how muddy I was. I was a little child, and that law was necessary. And if the law that I broke by coming onto the carpet was noticed by the authority figure, a second law came into place called the law of retribution. And I was spanked, right? So there was a natural consequence, and there was a penal consequence, all right? Well, when I go to my parents' house today, there's still mud, but I don't see that sign anymore. Why don't they have the sign up? Because I think like my dad now. I have my own house. I know what carpets are worth. I love carpets. I like cleanliness. I don't like mud. I grew up. So my dad doesn't need to put a sign up or my mom saying, do not walk on the carpet with muddy boots, because I don't want to do that. And so I'm not going to do it. And that's the secret of Christian liberty. Is your heart this afternoon in a position before the Lord where you want to do His will? If that isn't right, you cannot be free. If that is right, and you're walking in fellowship with the Lord, then all of life is open to you. And you can do what you want as long as we're careful to define who the you is. The you is not your flesh. The you is that new man created in Christ Jesus, the one who is a partaker of the divine nature, the one who loves God, the one, as we were hearing yesterday from Brother Bruce, is already flawless and perfect and ready for heaven. But it's still encased in a body. Now, you say that means the body's evil. No, no, no. That's an important distinction. The evil principle in humans sounds like body, but it isn't. It's flesh. Flesh is better thought of as a principle rather than an organ. Okay, or a set of organs. In a real sense, flesh is a condition I'm in that is not a space-occupying entity, as I was saying yesterday. It's a principle of selfishness. It's pure, unadulterated selfishness. It is the essence of Satan's sin, it is the essence of Adam's fall, and it is the basis of every other sin. It is pride with a capital P. That's the flesh. And yes, the flesh uses the body and manipulates its hormones and its desires and its appetites, but it is not the body that is evil, it is the flesh. And therefore, you are responsible with what you do for your body, not to make it the members of sin for unrighteousness, but to make your members, your bodily parts, the servants of Christ, so that they may perform righteous deeds and be used in his service. So, the apostle says in Romans 12, present your bodies. Now, he's promised us in Romans 8 that the body will be redeemed, but it's not yet. In fact, you could think of yourself in this way. I don't know if all of you will agree with this, but I'll throw it out to be provocative. There are three parts of the human. There's the part that we call the spirit that is now alive unto God, needs no further improvement, is absolutely ready for heaven, and could go there in a split second without any further modification. The soul is really in the same condition, but the body, not yet redeemed. That's not provocative. That's doctrine. I think we would all agree with that. You say, I thought redemption was in the past. Well, redemption comes in steps, my friends, because God's chosen to leave us in this world with unredeemed bodies, but with redeemed hearts, so that we might, through the trials and tribulations that we were told about yesterday, produce glory for God. That was his wisdom to do that, not to take us directly to heaven. That body is going to be redeemed. Romans 8 promises it in the day when the sons of God will be revealed. Then the body will be redeemed, and spirit, soul, body, the whole intact person will be sent to heaven. Now, the provocative part is this. Perhaps, if we do take the tripartite view of the human constitution, the soul is fully sanctified. The soul is being sanctified and the body shall be sanctified. But for those of you who don't like that arrangement, we can talk later. We're going to agree on this, that the body is valuable to God, the body is for the Lord, but the body is not redeemed, therefore the body is the battleground, right? That's what we're told in this chapter. So, we have a body that can do things because the person is not operating out of love. And just because I have only a few minutes, I want to rather spend the time on the second. We have a body that is subject to addictions and slavery. So when you go out there, remember the body is for the Lord and the Lord is for the body. If you want to turn that into a bracelet or a mantra, you can have my permission to do it if you care what I think, because that's something you need to etch in your minds. The body is for the Lord and the Lord is for the body. Whenever you take a step, you have to ask, not only is this going to benefit others, which is a very important topic I would love to develop, but for my purposes now, is this going to enslave me? Let's just be explicit about it. First of all, there are things that are clearly out there that will enslave us. You say, how do I know that I'm being enslaved? Well, we can look at this clinically. We can say, first of all, there's the principle of salience. Salience means that it is a pervasive part of my thinking and seems to be present at all times of the day and to involve all parts of my life so that I am nigh unto obsessed with the substance or with the entity that I am in danger of being in bondage to. Then we have a principle called tolerance, which means that the stimulus that was exciting at first is no longer exciting. And more is required in order to achieve anything like the initial rush. This is true of drugs, it's true of pornography, it's true of alcohol. And so increasingly greater doses are required to produce what was accomplished with the very first exposure. One of the messages here is don't have the first exposure. When you pick up that first drink, say the Lord is for the body and the body is for the Lord. I will not be brought under the power of any. Let me take that one for a minute. I'll take a little tangent here. There's a growing vogue among Christian people to begin to indulge in what we call social drinking. After all things are lawful for me, are they not? But drinking doesn't pass either of our tests. It is not beneficial, and it will enslave you. I can tell you, I have 10,000 hours in emergency rooms in my training and afterwards. I don't do that anymore. But you could shut the place down practically if it weren't for alcohol, especially after 9 o'clock at night. Alcohol will make you break every promise you have ever made to yourself, to every other person in your life, and to the Lord. It will make you break all of those promises. So, what does Lemuel's mother say to her, to him rather? It is not for kings, O Lemuel. Proverbs 31. It is not for kings to partake of alcohol or for princes to participate in strong or intoxicating drink. You say they drank alcohol in the Bible. Well, I would tell you they didn't drink 2015 alcohol in the Bible. You say, yes, they did, because some of them got drunk. They were even getting drunk at the Lord's Supper. They were using alcohol as a drug and a party substance. The average daily, mundane, pedestrian use of alcohol was diluted two-thirds with water and would take a prodigious amount to become drunk. And societal pressures and norms were such that this was not something that happened. It is not evil for us to do it today intrinsically. It is most unwise, and it does not pass either of our tests. It is not helpful, and it will bring me into bondage. I move on. There is something called withdrawal. Another phenomenon that we see when people are enslaved and their bodies have allowed to become chattel to things in their lives. I think some of you go through cell phone withdrawal, not to be too hard on that. But just think of it. If it's the first thing you do in the morning, it's the last thing you do at night. And if you have angst, and if you're 3/4 of the way to work, you remember your phone was left at home, and you're the type of person who will turn around and go back and be late for work. And if you need bigger and bigger doses of whatever you do on that, and if you get angry, another principle, if you get angry when people point out your excessive use, and if you get anxious whenever you can't find it, or panic at the very thought that somebody might have stolen it, you're an addict. I'm not saying they don't have their role. They do. And they're part of society. I'm not up here saying don't get a cell phone or don't use it. I'm saying respect the fact that your body will become addicted to everything and anything if you are not vigilant. So that's true as well as some of the more sordid things I'm talking about here. One of the things that our brother Leslie said, and with this I'll close, has to do with the reductionism of the people around us. They believe in a material body. They don't believe in a soul. They don't believe in a spirit. But our section, we didn't have time to develop it, talked about those who are hooked to a prostitute are one body, for two, says he, shall be one flesh, but he who is joined to the Lord is one spirit. I want to work with that for a minute. If it is true that I am only a biological entity before you with molecules and atoms that interact with each other and with a brain and mind that is purely a physical construct, then you must understand that everything I do is determined. There is no such thing as free will. Therefore, everything I do, I cannot be held responsible for. And the desires that I have are biological desires, and they cannot be said to be right or wrong. This is actually the very basis, logically, of gay marriage. It's called determinism. These people believe that this is in the cards, and there could be no other way, because it is simply a biological, physical phenomenon. And we must understand where they're coming from. That's absolutely not true. There is such a thing as free will. There is soul and there is spirit. And I'm going to say this to those of you who are interested in becoming something for God, in developing friendships that will be useful to you, and marrying someone who will be a blessing to you. You do not want to dwell merely at the physical level. You do not want to dwell merely at the soul level and be psychikos in Greek, a soulish person. But you need to start to relate to your fellow believers as you relate to your Lord in a spiritual plane. This is why the unequal yoke is so ridiculous from a, I shouldn't use that word, I don't mean to be cutting or dismissive, but it is so wrong and it's such folly. Think about this. You've come across a person who's not a believer, and you have a physical attraction, animal magnetism. That part works. But then, of course, you're spending your life with this person. So you might ask, do I have common interests? Do we both like to hike? Do we both like French food? Do we both like travel? Do we want 2 kids or 22 kids? That's important to talk about that kind of stuff. That's soul to soul. But I ask you, what do you have in common spiritually with the person who's not a believer? The most important core things in your life, your God, your salvation, and your future are shut out to that person. Body, soul, spirit. We worship together. We pray together. We talk about the things of the Lord together. We wonder about heaven together. We work in the Sunday school together. We go to worship the Lord together. We go up to the house of the Lord together, to quote the Hallel Psalms. We are one in spirit. You need to have spiritual people in your lives, not just at the spouse level, but also at the friend level, so that we can encourage each other and build each other in our most holy faith. So, as my time is gone and we're a couple minutes late for the break, let me leave you with this. The body is for the Lord, and the Lord is for the body. Don't ever forget that. How is the Lord for the body? Well, the Lord died for your body. And in order to do that, he had to take a body and never to relinquish it. He is a body. And he died for your body. Not only that, he lives for your body. Our brother Bruce has told us about what he's doing in heaven for us today. And he's coming for your body. There's no doubt the Lord is for your body. Now we ask ourselves in challenge, is my body for the Lord? May the Lord bless his word.